Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly, the world of tomorrow, brought to you today in a shiny new media package from The Guardian. It's a skeleton crew in the pod this week, with Jemima out on holiday and Charles attending to his broken finger. But me, I'm over the moon to be joined by our very own man in the field. Yes, it's our San Francisco technology guy, Bobby Johnson.
Hello.
Yeah, are you settling? Because you've been there for, what, about a month now?
Yeah, just over a month. It's taking a while. Time zones and, everything's a bit weird. We're getting there.
Anyway, on today's show, we're grilling new technology evangelist and publisher Tim O'Reilly about the next big internet things, plus the best ways for enterprise to get into Web 2.0. Also, in the wake of another high-profile hack attack, we're going to talk about this in a little bit, the victim this time was French President Nicolas Sarkozy, we're asking Tom from Garlic how best to protect ourselves in a digital world. Then, of course, there's the usual news and views, so do stick around. Tim O'Reilly has been credited with breaking the internet out of its Silicon Valley silo and into the worldwide wonder web it has become. The head of the ultimate technology publishing house and conference series, I managed to grab Tim for a few minutes of his time whilst at the Web 2.0 Expo in New York, and I began by asking him how much of the culture of Silicon Valley he thinks has been influenced and has influenced the development of the internet.
If you think about the way the future happens, it really often happens on the backs of crazy enthusiasts. I do a number of talks where I sort of go over this theme, and you look, for example, back at the Wright brothers. Invented modern aviation. Right? They were hobbyists, right? And they were passionate about all the little details, right? They were the hackers of their day. The auto industry. They were hackers. Look back at the beginnings of the personal computer industry. I have a slide where I show the first Apple One, which Steve Wozniak made in a wood shop. I Googled and found some pictures of early snowboards. These people had glued skis together. I mean, do you think they were just sort of the run-of-the-mill average people? No, they were the most passionate, most committed. And so, yeah, now we're in a world of software, and the hardcore geeks are out there inventing the future. They're doing stuff that at first looks wacky, and then people say, we could do something with that. And then the entrepreneurs come along and you start to build an ecosystem. And things that were once really hard, that seemed like magic, then suddenly become something that anyone can do. And so we, in fact, have based our whole company on that progression. We really look for technology that's bubbling up among people that I sometimes refer to as the alpha geeks. And then we watch to see when it's starting to cross the chasm. So back in 1991, 92, when we started following the World Wide Web, it was only a few people doing it. And some of the stuff was really hard. But we watched it. We said, this is really important. We fed it. And our mission at O'Reilly, as we describe it to ourselves, is changing the world by spreading the knowledge of innovators. So we find that a lot of those early communities share things informally. And so our publishing business was all about writing it down so that people the next ring out could adopt that technology. And then we figured out that we could do conferences, and you bring the early experts together to teach the next ring out. And we also realized pretty early on that one of the best ways to do marketing was actually to do advocacy for the technology, not for our products, about the technology. And I learned that from a guy named Brian Irwin, who I hired in 1992, the same time we published the book, the Whole Internet User's Guide and Catalog, which was the first commercial book about the internet. And Brian had been the director of activism at the Sierra Club. And he said, nobody's going to cover a book. And he said, let's go out there and use the book to market the internet. So we gave away lots and lots of copies of the internet. We started the Global Network Navigator, which was the first commercial website, really as a way of promoting the net and promoting the web and saying, hey, there's something here, pay attention. And ever since then, that's been a lot of what we've done. I started our conference business trying to market the Perl programming language, and then I realized, wait, all of my bestsellers nobody's paying attention to. So I gathered all the leaders of what came to be called the open source movement together and said, we have a marketing problem. We're having a press conference this afternoon. We're going to tell our story. And part of the story was, offering up a new name, open source, as opposed to free software. But that was issues-based marketing. And you know, obviously we did it again with Web 2. You know, everybody thought, you know, our corporate mission for the year 2003 was to reignite enthusiasm in the computer industry because everybody was in the dumps after the dot-com bust. And we said, no, there's a lot still going on. Let's tell a story that makes people see. And the best way, of course, to tell a story like that is to bring people together. And so we told the story through the people, through the community of people who were building that future. We're doing that right now with our magazine Make, which is celebrating the way that hackers are now starting to engage with computing and the physical world again. Everything from, you know, custom manufacturing to, you know, putting sensors in things, robotics. We do this event called Maker Faire. Last one we had 65,000 people. You know, it's a sort of like a county fair, except with robots instead of cows. But, you know, what we've done in each of these cases is we see this technology bubbling up, and we bring people together, and we try to tell a big story.
But once these ideas, once these quite profound ideas come out and infiltrate into the mainstream, ironically, they become more closed because people try and control them. So, for example, the corporate world is now engaging with participatory media products, mm-hmm. social media products, blogs, etc. And we're finding that, you know, we're finding a lot of people sending releases to bloggers and saying, could you please publish this and this and that and the other. So how would you propose that, not just with corporates, but, say, governments and other people who are really trying to get people to participate, to engage with their products, their philosophies and ideas, how would you propose to them or convince them that it's to relinquish that control and to stay with the philosophy of keeping it open, keeping it participatory?
Well, first off, I would like to invoke something that science fiction writers refer to as Sturgeon's Law. Somebody once complained to science fiction writer Theodore Sturgeon that 95% of science fiction was crap. And his response was 95% of everything is crap, right? And, you know, so there are a lot of people who don't get social media, you know, who, you know, they hire their PR agency to, you know, say, you know, send an email to bloggers as opposed to having a direct communication from the people at the company. They don't get it, right? 95% of people don't get it. The ones who do prosper. Web 2.0 and the enterprise is actually less about harnessing social media and more about learning from people like Google and Amazon. How do you actually make an enterprise that learns from its customers? Because it's not just the explicit participation of, say a Dell IdeaStorm. In my presentation today, I pointed out that Dell's original supply chain was more Web 2.0 than, say, Dell IdeaStorm. Because what they did was they actually were monitoring what are people buying, and then they had that information floating all the way back down the supply chain, and they would make more in real time. You know, so Dell was a more real-time company in the way that Google was more real-time than Yahoo. You know, Google, you know, a lot of people say, you know, that Yahoo acquired, you know, which acquired Overture was really the originator of the ad auction for these little text ads. But the difference is that Google figured something out that Yahoo didn't. Yahoo sold ads to the highest bidder, and Google didn't, because Google took the next step of actually instrumenting the application so that they could say right now, you know, this ad only wants to pay half as much, but it gets clicked on three times as much. Therefore, we'll make more money, and the users will be happier. And that was the breakthrough of AdWords. It's that real-time enterprise that I think is the heart of Web 2.0 for the enterprise. How do you actually, every business has customers. They have thousands, maybe millions of customer touch points. But what do they do with that data? They throw it away or they put it in a back office. Maybe somebody does some data mining against it occasionally. But if you look at a Google or an Amazon, they've made that loop, right? That's why I love Microsoft's name for Web 2.0. It's actually live software, because it actually captures a lot of what's true about Web 2.0. And in the enterprise, your goal should be to make live software.
That was Tim O'Reilly. Now, Bobby, you're a newbie on the San Francisco scene, but you've been covering it for many years as technology correspondent. How much is the culture there responsible for the web as we know it?
Oh, I think, it's a mixture of things. I mean, we have to remember the beauty of the web is that it's a worldwide thing, and I think that's certainly changed, you know, the Silicon Valley mindset a bit and started it thinking about the wider world. But it really is the epicenter of what goes on, and, you know, walking around the streets and people are just talking about the internet and the web in a way that you don't see in other places. I mean, this is really where a lot of stuff happens. But I think if you think about it politically and philosophically, I mean, the kind of Californian West Coast liberal libertarian mindset is massively influential. If you look at all of the ways that we think about the web, they're all kind of based in this modern hippie ideal, I think, about how we relate to other people and to information.
Well, I find it interesting to hear you say that, because I've spent a little bit of time in that that lovely modern hippie environment, and I found it actually quite closed off from the rest of the world. And while you say that they're paying attention to the world on the basis of the fact that they're dealing with the web, it is still, because everybody's there, they don't necessarily have to look outside to get fodder from within. But within that idea, I was wondering what you, having been situated in that culture and having spoken with people in San Francisco now for a little while, what you and what people there view are the unique selling points of British web companies and British new technology.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, when we think about successful British technology companies, often they're, you know, they're, we don't actually think that they're British. I mean, you look at a big telecoms company like Vodafone, nobody really thinks of that as a British company. If you look at, you know, web companies, a lot of the ones that have come out of the UK, they don't make that much of themselves about being British or being non-American. I think that's a kind of losing strategy for people. But I think there are unique things about Britain that can work. I mean, for example, if you're a startup based in London, say, you're really close to the web industry in Britain. You're really close to the advertising industry, all the creative industries, the music industry. That it's all in one place. If you come back over to America, Silicon Valley is totally removed from Los Angeles and Hollywood and the music industry. It's totally removed from New York and the advertising industry and all the business that goes on there. And that's a really difficult thing to get over. And I think, you know, British companies can have a big impact in just getting those things tighter. They can also, I think one of these ideas about kind of being bespoke and handmade and kind of really touchy-feely is something that you can kind of try and do in a different way if you're British. You know, you want to get across some of those kind of great traditional UK ideas and the feel of your company. So I think it's much more about the intangible stuff than the obvious, you know, let's do this, let's do that.
Well, speaking of intangibles, some of the things that Tim was touching on during that interview was we were talking a lot about control. Who controls the content? How does enterprise in particular control or reduce its amount of control that it wants to maintain over some of its Web 2 enterprises, you know, some of blogs and the various the Twitter feeds, etc. And from your point of view, do you actually think that enterprise is going to get it, or do you see this becoming a split where you've got the traditional enterprise, the traditional companies, and then those companies who, you know, may or may not be as successful or whatever, but they, you know, they do get the whole notion behind Web 2?
Yeah, that's really tough. I think, I mean, from Tim O'Reilly's point of view, you know, the real money is made in convincing companies that they need to be part of this. I mean, there's the Web 2.0 Expo going on in Berlin this week. Next month, there's the Web 2.0 Summit, which is where they charge enormous amounts of money for people to come along and learn about these things. I think a lot of companies want to do this because they see some value in it. They see people using this stuff. And they want to get it themselves. Whether they actually do the things that people want is a different kettle of fish. I mean, the consumer side of stuff, the services we use are different and will always be different to the stuff that gets subsumed inside your company. And that's just the way of the world. But I think, you know, you can't ignore things forever. And we're starting to see, you know, the kind of Facebookization of a lot of companies and things starting to come through there. It all gets subsumed into one enormous blob. I mean, we don't have to differentiate, you know, little bits of culture here and there. It's just the way things are.
Well, we'll hear more from Tim O'Reilly later in the show, and hopefully more about that blob. Bobby, I like the idea of that. Subsumed into this giant Web 2.0 enigma. In the meantime, Bobby, tell us a bit about the news.
The economic downturn continues to hit the technology industry, with cutbacks across high-tech companies of all sizes in recent weeks. Fresh reports suggest that Yahoo could be the next on the hit list, with pundits predicting that the company is preparing to shed more than 1,000 jobs. Gamers waiting for Sony's autumn blockbuster Little Big Planet are going to have to hold their fire after a religious controversy caused the game to be delayed. Worldwide release was pushed back after concerns over two lines from the Quran, which were quoted in one of the in-game songs. British gamers will now have to wait until November the 3rd to get their hands on it. French President Nicolas Sarkozy has admitted becoming a victim of online fraud, after criminals obtained his passwords and siphoned cash out of his personal bank account. French police have launched an inquiry to find out who the culprits are. And finally, the growing amount of technology in our homes is causing havoc for household pets across the country. That's according to a survey that says the rise in gadgets and gizmos has led to increasing amounts of injuries caused as curious cats and dogs negotiate modern living rooms.
Tech Weekly from Guardian.co.uk.
The Yahoo story. I know that there's nothing confirmed yet, but this is a nice little it's a nice little extension to what we were talking about last week with the possibility of the credit crunch actually hitting.
Yeah, I mean, there've been layoffs here, there, and everywhere. You know, from big companies like HP cutting thousands and thousands of jobs. Down to a lot of startups just trimming back and dropping a few people here or there. But I think Yahoo, you know, being one of the big three or four or five companies that really dominate the internet space, eBay made some layoffs. We haven't seen much yet from Microsoft or Google or Amazon. But yeah, it's not good news for anyone, particularly if you work for Yahoo. But it also is a bigger signal of how things are crunching up.
Well, if you take a look back, say at the BBC about 10 years ago, they did a massive series of layoffs at around the same time as they split into sort of two different arms, wherein one was the production side and one was the kind of management side. And all the people that they laid off from production side, they subsequently hired back, but as independents. And do you think that that's going to be a trend that's going to be happening? For example, do you have any idea where these layoffs are going to come from within the company? Is it likely that they'll then be hired back in as freelancers as opposed to full-bodied members of the company?
I think that's pretty unlikely. I mean, the main reason that people's jobs are being lost is because there just isn't the business to keep them in work. I mean, Yahoo's been on the back foot for a few years now, and is really getting whacked left, right, and centre, really, from everybody. But if you look at the things that they're doing, there's this deal with Google. They've got to switch out some of their advertising to Google. Obviously, that's not good news if you work on advertising at Yahoo. There are lots of big infrastructure projects that maybe they can scale back or start to cut back. They've also been switching around jobs in their worldwide offices as well as just down in the valley. So, I mean, we've already seen their plans to close down their UK operation and move it all to Switzerland. So I think, you know, we might see lots of those jobs go as well, because they really want to concentrate on their home market and just making sure they see it through to the other side.
Well, another story that I wanted to touch on a little bit closer to my own heart in the games world is the Little Big Planet story, Bobby. Now, what is the story here?
So it's a kind of slightly complicated one, and I had to look at it a few times, I think, to try and work out what was going on. But basically, in one of the levels on Little Big Planet, there's a soundtrack in the background, which is a piece of music they've licensed from elsewhere, and it has a couple of lines from the Quran in it, which in translation, apparently one of them's every soul shall have the taste of death, and the other one is all that is on earth will perish. Now, when I first read that, I thought maybe it's because it's a, you know, there's a violent theme going on there or something, but actually that's not the case. This is some Muslim beta testers, basically, who said maybe some people will be offended because there are lines from the Holy Book being used in pop music. So Sony and Media Molecule decided, let's drop the track, let's send out a patch and get it sorted. So it's a kind of a freedom of speech issue almost, and I don't know about you, but I'm kind of confused about it. This is a music track that's done by a guy who's really famous world music singer. You know, the track's been out for a few years. Nobody seems to have been too offended by it in the past. But, you know, Sony has a weird track record with, potentially offensive religious issues. So maybe that's where they're coming from.
Well, it certainly does, because a couple of years ago, they had to pull Resistance Fall of Man, which was a PlayStation game that had a very, very violent scene. Set in Manchester Cathedral. And in came the Church of England, I believe, and said, we don't like to be associated with that. We find it a little bit uncomfortable, I think was the technical term that they used. But it does seem strange that with Resistance Fall of Man, they took a very strong stance against not taking it off the shelves and were ultimately just forced to in the end by a whole variety of legal battles. Whereas in this one, which is an almost impossibly innocuous game, they've proactively taken the game back before it was actually released. So yes, you're right. It's a very complex and confusing and conflicting series of messages that they're sending out.
Yeah, I mean, I think it'd be interesting to hear from the listeners, really, you know, on what you think. I'm sure they can go to the games blog and talk about that, but it just strikes me that there's this kind of weird capitulation here from Sony when we saw completely the opposite previously. But also I just wonder how much of this is just basically a business decision that's being blown out of the water, because Little Big Planet isn't, you know, it's not out there on the shelves. They don't have to recall stuff. That was their problem with Resistance, was, you know, they'd already got thousands of copies in shops. They didn't want to pull them back. This time they can jump in there and act more proactively and avoid controversy. But in avoiding controversy, they've caused it anyway.
Right. And then finally, Bobby, just briefly to touch on this, what's going on with the pets thing? I thought my cat, you know, I thought he was in danger of dying from eating too much hummus, but I hadn't actually thought that he would be in danger from all of the wires and the wireless and all that kind of stuff. What's happening with his little brain?
Well, this was just a little one that came out of a survey by take it with a pinch of salt, because it came from a pet insurance specialist, but they did a survey of things that happened to pets and discovered that apparently your cat is most likely to be injured by your iPod. Your rabbit, for some reason, has a particular issue with the PlayStation. And guinea pigs need to avoid remote controls. But basically what they're saying is that, you know, there's so much technology in the house, so many wires, so many cables, that your poor pet is it's like a jungle out there.
As far as I'm concerned, I have an indoor cat, much to my great dismay. I've always had outdoor cats. But Spartapus the cat does not go outdoors.
Yes.
And personally, I fear, because he is such a well, a freak, really. I fear more that he's going to end up going outdoors and getting run over by a car than getting hit in the head by my iPod or other MP3 products out there. I don't really understand the dangers.
Yeah, well, I've got two cats, and they're one of them is obsessed with the microphone that I'm using right now. And so I wonder whether either she'll manage to electrocute herself somehow, or we'll just make a starring appearance on the podcast one time because she rubs herself up and down the microphone as some kind of scratch pad.
I think that's more likely. Well, we'll have, is it Widget?
It's Widget, yes, Widget.
Well, we'll have Widget on the program in the future. And sadly, Widget is unavailable to comment as yet because I think you poked her in the eye with a pen when she came over.
Not in the eye, just general warding off with sharp implements.
I think your cat has more danger from you than from your technology. But anyway, you can read about all these stories and more at guardian.co.uk/technology. So, Bobby, lots to think about this week in the podcast and, of course, on the blogs. What's been happening on the technology blog?
Oh, lots of stuff. Jack's been celebrating the fact that it's 25 years since we've been doing what we've been doing in The Guardian. So bit of reminiscence there. I tried to lighten the mood last week. It's all been very, very downbeat and, economically crappy recently. So I asked people to tell us their funniest geeky jokes. Go and see for yourself and decide whether it was a success or failure. I mean, there were several people who came up with there are 10 sorts of people in the world, those who understand binary and those who don't. It's not the worst geek joke, but it's certainly the most overtold.
I got it. Oh, it hurts, though. It does hurt. Well, over on the games blog, and that's not a bad idea. I might copy you there, Bobby, and I might ask people to send in their best game-related jokes, because I'm sure that there are many, 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 many out there. Can't think of any at the minute. That's why I'm terrible at dinner parties. But on the games blog, we mentioned that well, it feels like it's a Little Big Planet podcast, actually, because we're talking about Little Big Planet on the blog as well. It's stirred up quite a lot of responses already, and several of the commentators have mentioned the association and the conflict that Bobby, you and I mentioned with Resistance, Fall of Man. But Killer B says, whatever the rights and wrongs of certain people being offended by the lyrics to a background song, he says, I think Sony did the right thing. Yes, it's annoying to have a highly anticipated game delayed. And yes, I'd just like to clarify that it is annoying because I've been looking forward to this for a long time. That was me, by the way. That wasn't Killer B. But they really couldn't afford to have any sort of controversy like this dragging on. Even a day zero patch to fix the problem would have given some troublemakers reason to kick up a fuss and start legal action or whatever. That would probably far outweigh the cost of a pre-release recall. So that's what folks are saying online. You can read all about these stories and more. Submit your geek and your game jokes. And, of course, do get involved with the Little Big Planet discussion at guardian.co.uk/technology/gamesblog/technology. And don't forget to head to the I Love the Guardian's Tech Weekly podcast Facebook group. We do love hearing from you there. And, yes, I have already put up the name of the website that somebody was looking for, which was related to the music podcast that we did a couple of weeks ago. So go over there and check that out. If presidential types can't secure their personal bank accounts, as we just found out in the news, what hopes do we, mere mortals, have to keep our online identities secure? Jemima Kish, our new media correspondent who is away on holiday at the minute, spoke with Tom Elyoub from web service Garlic before she went away to get the skinny on the little things that we can do to protect ourselves.
The issue of ID theft is growing. There are about 130,000 cases of ID theft a year in the UK, and it's growing at about 40% a year. A lot of that ID theft occurs online because criminals have realised that a lot of our personal information is available in the digital world. So what Garlic does on that side with a product called Data Patrol is we sweep the digital world on a weekly basis looking for where your personal information is, who's got it, how they got it, and what you can do to remove it or what you can do to minimize it so that you reduce the risk of being a victim of identity theft.
So does that mean the information we put about holidays and details of our friends and things on Facebook, or is it more kind of serious, more hard data than that?
What the fraudster is looking for is a combination of hard data and soft data. So there'll be information that you might have put on the electoral roll and you haven't ticked the box saying remove it, and therefore it finds its way into the public domain. You might have done planning applications and signed your name at the bottom, not realizing that your local authority publishes all those applications these days. You might be a company director and not realize that Companies House publish your home information and your date of birth and so forth. Your mother's maiden name might appear somewhere. So all of that hard information will be out there. But the fraudster will try and combine that with the soft information in the social networking sites, if they can find it, if you haven't made it private, in order to build up a complete picture of you, in order to take advantage of your identity.
And how about that softer information? Because there is there's a more positive side to our kind of digital personas and all the information that we have on social networking sites and perhaps on our own blogs. How does garlic sort of help nurture the more positive side of our digital information?
Yeah. Absolutely. There are two sides to this coin. Your digital status is a huge asset. In fact, for a lot of people, it's probably the most valuable asset that they have. And if you can nurture it and make sure people know you for what you want to be known for, then it opens up all sorts of opportunities. An increasing number of people look for information about you before they offer you a job, before they do business with you, before they date you. And therefore, what we try and do on that side, we've launched a service called QDOS, QDOS, that measures your digital status so that you can understand what the size and shape of your digital status is and therefore start to manage it and mold it in a way that really reflects how you want to be seen in the digital world.
So pseudonyms then, is it a good idea in some ways for thinking about identity theft? It seems to be a good idea to have pseudonyms and to disguise your persona online. But when it comes to the positive side of trying to maybe, you know, promote your business or who you are or the work that you do, it seems, and so that people can find you as well, it seems sensible to use your real name. What's your view on pseudonyms?
I think pseudonyms is a really interesting issue. The way we think about identity in the digital world, and should you just have one single identity or should you have multiple identities, I think we should feel quite relaxed about that. And in a way, having pseudonyms gives you an element of power, because you decide whether you join them up, you decide whether people can combine the real world you with the digital you. A lot of bloggers you'll find will have their blog in one name and their real world information in another name. I think that's fine. That's the world we live in.
As a guru for the technology set, Tim O'Reilly keeps his eyes open wide when it comes to new technologies. He's so influential, it's quite impressive, that some have called him a meme peddler. What in the world does that mean? I asked him myself.
Well, let me start by saying, first of all, peddler suggests that you're just sort of peddling any old meme. And the way I frame it, there's a wonderful quote from Edwin Schlossberg. He said, "The skill of writing is to create a context in which other people can think." And a lot of what we've done over the years has been to frame things in such a way that people were able to see something that they couldn't see before. You know, so when we brought together this group of hackers who, we knew they were important because they, their technologies were the subject of all our best-selling books, but nobody was talking about it. And we got everybody to talk about it by coming up with a name. You know, we brought them all together and we said, hey, and in the course of the meeting, we voted on, several proposed names. Open source, which had been invented a few weeks before by someone else, was voted on, agreed on. And then we put that meme out there and we told a story about what it meant. And it took hold and it helped people to see something that was there and that mattered. Similarly, Web 2.0, we said, the web isn't dead, it's coming back, pay attention. With Make, one of the things that I love, the first Maker Faire, Dale Doherty, who was the guy who came up with the concept. He also, incidentally, was the one who actually used the term Web 2.0. I was just calling it the Internet Operating System. In one pavilion, there was this event called the Swap-a-rama-rama, which is this clothing swap where people actually remanufacture the clothes. There's sewing machines, there's silk screening machines, people to help. Then they have a fashion show at the end of the day, all the way that you remade the Okay, and over in the next pavilion is a bunch of Linux geeks showing off their biodiesel-powered supercomputer made from recycled PCs. And Dale's brilliance with Make was to say, both of these people are makers. Like, he created a new name that was an umbrella that gave people an identity that said, yeah, there's something in common here. People are rejecting this idea that you just buy stuff, that instead you can make stuff. And so peddling a meme is really about, you know, helping people to see. You know, the memes that matter, the new memes, are ones that, that are really tools for thinking. You know, when Tom Friedman, you know, wrote The World is Flat, he gave us, a meme, but he also gave us an ability to see something that a lot of people hadn't really seen before. It's not something you do casually. You know, it's not like a marketing discipline. Oh, yeah, let's make a new meme. You know, and people will try to do it. But to do it really successfully, you have to be adding value where you're really seeing something that matters.
That was Tim O'Reilly. So, Bobby, do you think that the geek community would be as successful without a Tim O'Reilly to publicize them? Because he's a pretty good publicist, and that really is his raison d'etre.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you have a number of people who kind of act as magnets for discussions or for ideas. I think, you know, if it wasn't Tim, there would be someone. There generally is when you've got, you know, a large volume of people all thinking about similar topics. But because he's in a fairly unique position as a publisher and events coordinator, that he can kind of, his job is to do that, you know, is to be a person who starts conversations or makes you, you know, brings ideas up that maybe you haven't thought about before. So I think, you know, he does a good job of it, but I think that, you know, somebody else would fill in his absence.
But what is interesting, though, is how the ideas, as I said to him, how his ideas have managed to infiltrate the mainstream. And while he himself admits that he didn't devise the Web 2.0 name and he didn't come up with the name open source, he is commonly, you know, considered the person who brought those ideas outside of the geek community. And how he's managed that has been pretty impressive.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't want to do him down at all, but I just think, you know, well, for a start, I have to question whether some of those things have really broken out of the geek community properly, or maybe it's the fact that the geek community is growing larger in itself, you know, and more diverse and broader. So, you know, you see ideas get traction and move, and I think there are numbers of people who are involved in that, and the ones who can make a rallying cry are really important. But you also need, you know, you need ordinary people to be interested in what's going on first. So it's a chicken and an egg situation, really.
That's it for this week's edition of Tech Weekly. Cheers to our guests, Tim O'Reilly, Tom Eliub, and our in-house specialist. Yes, Bobby, that's you. Thanks also to our special guest producer, Ben Green, over there in the glass box, waving hi. I'm Alex Kratosky, and I'm away for the next month voting in the US and working on my PhD. However, the podcast will be here with familiar faces and voices. So do tune in next Tuesday to find out who they've bullied into the job. Me, I'll see you in December. Have a good one.